Good morning, everyone. I want to welcome you to week number four of our series called Created for Significance. And it's been a fun time. Hopefully you got your worksheets. Does everybody have a worksheet, a bulletin? If you've got your worksheet, if not, there's some extras on the back table there. And I hand these out because I like you to have something in your hand that you can write with, that you can keep during the week, and if you want to refer back to it, you can. So, anyone who has raised more than one child knows that because each of them has a unique temperament and motivational style, you often speak differently to one child than you do to the other. You know, our daughter Jessica was one that we rarely had to spank. You gave her the look like, I'm very disappointed in you, and she was on the floor crying. You know, I mean, she was just like devastated that she could have hurt somebody. Our sons, on the other hand, had what we called lead bottoms, because it didn't matter when we spanked them. It didn't seem to do anything, and we had to find that particular thing that spoke to them, that motivated them. And so you know that that's how it goes. And anyone who's been a part of a group knows that there are times when you speak differently to those inside the group than you do to those outside the group. In fact, even within a group many times, because there are often the curious and the casual, as well as the committed, often the way a person talks to the various types inside the group will vary and differ, okay? So you understand what I'm saying with this, right? So over the past few weeks, we have been listening to Jesus tell stories to one type of people. He's been talking to the highly trained, highly educated group of people known as, religious group of people known as the Pharisees. In Luke 14 and 15, Jesus has all sorts of stories to tell these people. You know, stories so good that they've been recorded. And they've read, they've learned countless times in the past 2,000 years, and maybe you have too. Maybe you've read these things countless times. But if you've been here the past 3 or 4 weeks, you know that those stories are stories of the great banquet, the lost sheep, and the lost coin, and the wayward son. And if you've been here, if you haven't been here, then if you're curious about this series, then you can see one of our sound technicians and we can get you a CD or bring you up to speed, or you can wait a week or so and catch it all on our website, and you can listen to it right from the website if you're interested. But while Jesus is telling those stories, he's aware of another group that's close by that's listening in, a group that doesn't oppose him like the Pharisees do. It's a group that has been there supporting him all along, a group of insiders, a group so committed to him that they had bet the farm, that following him was the best decision of their lives. So, in Jesus' typical fashion, when he gets through talking with the outsiders, he then turns to those close followers, and he talks to them for a while. He tells them a very intriguing story about a scoundrel who'd bet the farm on a person that he had offended, a person that he had mistreated. But because of the character of the mistreated one, the scoundrel won the bet, and he secured his very prosperous future. And that's a story that I want to tell you today. If you're here today and you're wondering whether God can be trusted and whether you'd ever want to trust your life to him, you're going to like the way that this story turns out. If you're a believer and you've made a mild commitment to Christ, but you wonder if you should commit everything to him, you're going to want to take that step of faith after you hear this story. If you are a genuine spiritual soldier, fully invested, committed to everything, you've committed everything to him, your time, your talents, your treasure, then when the story is done, you're going to say, I'm so glad that I've given 100% to Jesus. And I think there is something in this story for everybody today. And like last week when I shared with you that I'm going to talk to you for a while and pretend that you know virtually nothing about first century Palestinian culture, and I'm going to give you all sorts of brain candy to chew on so that you can see this story in the way the original hearers saw it and heard it. So get your worksheets out and write quickly, okay? Ready? Let's start, shall we? Let's start with the very elementary, okay? Luke 16 is the chapter in the Bible that immediately follows Luke chapter 15. Okay, everybody with me on that? Okay, I said we were going to get real elementary here. When he finishes addressing the Pharisees, Jesus turns to his disciples and he tells them the story of this shrewd manager. It's a story about a rich guy, you know, he's a nobleman, who finds out that he's being cheated by one of his employees. So he fires the employee, who then does something very creative and unethical to ensure his future. Now, the twist to the story is, instead of being outraged at this, the nobleman praises the manager for being a shrewd operator. I almost said smooth operator, but he was smooth, but he was a shrewd operator. Don't want to give any kudos to Sade this morning, okay? Did you go over your head?
I got it.
Okay, good, okay. For centuries, this story, I believe, has confounded logical right-brained Western thinkers. Because for the life of them, they can't understand why Jesus or the character that represents God in this story would praise someone for doing something unethical. They've come up with a lot of theories of how this might work or what's wrong with the story. But all of them miss the mark unless they know something about Middle Eastern culture. Now, 30 minutes from now or so, you all are going to be experts on this. Well, hopefully. So, with what we're going to cover, you'll be able to walk out of here and act like a Pharisee. You'll know more than everyone else at the office. You'll secretly feel that you're just a little bit superior because you know these things. See the wink? The story of the shrewd manager is a story that Jesus tells in four scenes. And we're going to talk about those scenes first of all. The first scene is in the master's office. And this is where the scoundrel gets word that he's being laid off. You know, he's the downsized or kicked out or laid off or fired, you know, all of the other terms that you hear regularly when the economy is going bad, all right? You hear them not so much these days because our economy has been pretty good, but, you know, in when the economy is low, you hear laid off, cutbacks, all of those things. You hear those words all the time. And the second scene is on the way to get the books. And this is where some huge thinking goes on, you know. It's where he's revealing what this unscrupulous manager knows to be true about the man that he's been cheating, even though the man has treated him so well and given him so much responsibility. The third scene is with the books. This is where the manager works the plan that he hatched on the way to get the books. And the plan works flawlessly, and then scene four is in the master's office once again. This is where the climax comes to the story. Now, let me walk you through each of these scenes so that you can see them, you know, digitally enhanced and hear them in Dolby surround sound. You know, I know I said that last week, but that's kind of what our desire is for this. So, how are you going to invest your one and only life? That's the name of today's. And scene one takes place in the master's office. Okay. In this scene, there are three characters introduced, though only two of them are actually in the room. The first character is the master. He is the wealthy Middle Eastern landowner, and Jesus calls him a rich man, and he tells us that the people in the area respect him so much that many of them come to him to tell him that his regional manager is cheating him. Jesus' exact words to this in this story are this: there was a rich man in verse 2. Chapter 16, verse 2. There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. Now, the tense of this verb in the original language indicates that the manager was accused repeatedly of this kind of embezzlement. So, the master asks him about it very calmly and very graciously. He doesn't scold, he doesn't berate, he doesn't threaten, he doesn't demand repayment or put the manager in jail, which he had every right to do. But he's an impressive landlord. And the second character, the first character mentioned is the master, the landlord, and the second one is the manager. He's an agent for the master. He's the middleman, as we would call it. He manages the property and assets that don't belong to him. Only he's not managing them. He's been mismanaging them. He's a rascal who's been cooking the books for his own advantage. Now, according to the Mishnah, the Jewish commentary on the Old Testament, there were three kinds of managers legally recognized to play a management function in the life of Israel. This man was a shalua in Hebrew, and the Greek word used here for him was oikonomos, which sounds very close to our word economist. He's an educated man who has worked all his life with people and contracts and records. He's an agent hired by the master to negotiate and administer land contracts between the master and the peasants who work the land. In the 1500s, when the Ottoman Turks conquered this area, they divided the land up amongst themselves, and then they rented it back to the locals in exchange for a certain percentage of the crops. The peasants hated these landowners because they expected them to do certain things they never got. These landowners exploited them. They bled them dry, and they usually were what was called absentee landlords. They were very uninvolved and unconcerned in local affairs. They were represented by managers like this one in the story. And those managers not only bilked them for the master's gain, but they bilked them a second time on the side for their own personal gain. Now, Kenneth Bailey, who I mentioned last week, lived in this region for 15 years, and he did a lot of research in this area. And this is something he wrote about this area. He writes, "The Turkish landowner is vividly remembered as corrupt, ruthless, and indifferent to any suffering he or his steward might cause his renters. But this scene is quite different from the one in the parable. At the very beginning, someone cares enough about the welfare of the master to report the actions of the dishonest steward. The master is clearly part of the community. The wealthy, distant, foreign, ruthless landowner is unknown in this parable." Okay. And that is the third group that is mentioned in this story, and is the peasants, the debtors, the people who work the land. They're not present here. Every year, each of them negotiated with the master through the manager to farm a certain number of acres in exchange for the right to farm. The master gets a specified amount of wheat or olive oil, or whatever the crop may be that they are farming. It is the peasants who have blown the whistle on this shrewd manager, and that sets up the action, okay? The entire action of scene one takes place in two sentences, both from the lips of the master. The first sentence is a question. The master calls this. He says, "What is this I hear about you?" He is very careful with his words and the words he chooses. He doesn't say, "I hear you've been cheating me. I hear you've been ripping me off." No, because that would tip the manager off to what the master already knows about him. The landlord doesn't want to tell the manager everything that he knows because he wants to know everything that this scoundrel has been up to. So he says, "What's this I hear about you?" Now, all the listeners hearing Jesus' story would expect one and only one response to a question like this: silence. And in Jesus' story, the manager doesn't disappoint them. The received response is silence. The manager is smart enough not to give any answer because he doesn't know what exactly the master knows about his dealings. Does he know everything, or does he just know a few things? He doesn't want to confess to any more than the master can already prove. So he stays quiet. Then the master delivers a second sentence. He gives the manager his dismissal. He goes, "You can no longer be manager," he says. And translated, it means, "You're done. You're fired. You're gone. Don't let the door hit you on the way out." Okay? Now, at this point, all the listeners expect to hear a debate or argument from the manager. That's the expected response, was argument. You know, there are a lot of things that he can say to defend himself. You know, he could blame other people, because it seems like even to this day, we're still really good at that, blaming others. He can claim ignorance. You know, we're good at that as well. You know, "Well, I didn't know." Or he can just say that it was an oversight. You know, he could do that. He can put the onus on the master himself. This is the time for him to explain why he's innocent and why he ought to be retained. But to the surprise of the listeners, the manager stays silent. So the received response is still silence. Now, silence is supremely significant in this setting. It is very significant. The manager is indirectly affirming at least some of the following that I'm going to say. He's affirming, "I'm guilty. The master knows I'm guilty. The master expects obedience. Disobedience will bring judgment. I can't get my job back by offering excuses." See, this manager, this shrewd manager, doesn't dwell on how he can get his job back because he knows he can't. All his energy is focused on the future and what he is going to do now that he is unemployed. So before he ever even leaves the boss's office, he begins processing things that he knows and weighing his options. The master has told him that he's fired and that he must turn in the company books. So now what is he going to do? He's thinking all about this as he leaves the office. As he closes the door, he thinks to himself, "At least he didn't throw me in jail." The Mishnah, the Jewish book of commentary, makes it quite clear that an agent was expected to pay for any loss for which he was responsible. And the master hasn't even asked that of him. He's not even scolded. He just releases him, lets him go. So he says, "He is a merciful man." That's what the manager says to himself. And then that leads us into scene two. And scene two takes place on the way to get the books. The master has said, "Give an account of your management," verse 2 of Luke 16. How does an accountant account for his work? He keeps records. He keeps books. Yeah. In Middle Eastern culture, when a person is fired, they're fired on the spot. I think it's probably the same in our culture. When you get fired, you're fired on the spot. You don't finish out the day. You don't finish out the week or the pay period. Most time they say if you're fired, you're fired. Now, if you're being laid off for cutbacks, they might allow you to finish the day or might allow you to finish the pay period. But there's no severance pay. There's no 30 days notice. This guy is terminated, done, finito. He's gone. And he's now powerless, he's friendless, and he's without a job. So what's he going to do? He only has one task left to do, go and get the books. So on his way to get the books, he's thinking furiously. His brain is just going 100 miles an hour. In verse 3, he says, "What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job." So he's mulling over his options. He says, well, I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg, in verse 3. And while he's walking, his mind just continues whirling and spinning, and he hatches a plan. And the plan is based on everything he knows about the master. So his thinking goes something like this. I have been manipulating another man's money for years, and everyone around here knows it. I'm too weak to have manual labor, and begging is beneath my station. It's below my level of dignity. So what am I going to do? His problem is, who will hire me? His answer is, no one. They all know his reputation. Nobody likes him, or they wouldn't have turned him in the first place. Nobody trusts him. There is no way in his current state of popularity that he could hope to find a job in that area. His reputation won't allow it. So he thinks and he thinks and he comes up with a solution not based on his reputation, but based on his master's reputation. So what is the solution he comes up with? Trust in the master's mercy. After all, this is a man who was so kind, he didn't even reprimand the manager when he let him go. He didn't demand repayment. He didn't make a fuss. This man is generous. This man is merciful. He says, I know what I'll do. I'll stake my entire future on the master's reputation. And so he does. That leads us into scene 3. And that is with the books. Scene 3 happens with the books. And this reveals the plan that he's hatched. Now, ironically, the plan has everything to do with the master and nothing to do with the manager. So the manager has to move fast because his entire future depends on changing the villagers' perception of him so that one of them will give him a job. Now, he's got to change the minds of the master's debtors, and he's got to do it before they discover that he's no longer has any power or authority. Everything takes place in this scene. And everything that takes place here comes from the mind of the manager and is based on two assumptions. And the manager knows that for his plan to work, the debtors must assume two things. First of all, the debtors must assume that the manager is still in authority. They need to assume that. They must believe that he still works for the manager. They must believe that he still manages the legal contracts between them and the master. So as soon as he gets back to the office, he finds one of the servants and he says to them, summon all of my master's debtors. See, the peasants don't know yet that he's been fired. They assume that his summons is an official one, you know, sanctioned by the master. And as soon as the first tenant farmer shows up, he pulls his contract out of the file and he lays it down in front of him and he says, quick, verse 5, if you're following along, verse 5 of chapter 16 of Luke, quick, how much do you owe the master? And the farmer says, 800 gallons of olive oil. And the manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400 that you owe. He calls the next one in, lays his contract in front of him. Verse 7 says, then he asks the second, how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. Take your bill and make it 800. Now, in actual monetary value, the debts are both reduced by the same amount, 500 denarii. The manager isn't thinking percentages, he's thinking speed. He knows he must complete every deal before a servant walks in and says, hey, I heard you got canned. If that happens, his plan collapses and he goes to jail. Now, the second assumption the debtors must hold is that the master has approved of this debt reduction. If not, they'll never go along with it. They'll never change their perceptions of him, and he has no future at all. But lightning fast, he pulls it off. He pulls the whole thing off. And one by one, the tenant farmers come up, and they all have their bills reduced. This is what you call betting the farm on your idea. And the manager is risking everything based on what he knows about his master. That the master is generous and merciful. And if this is true, if the master really is generous and merciful, he'll be okay. If he's wrong, it's the Jewish Folsom prison for him. He's bet the farm. He stakes everything on this. Everything. Hello. Now, understand this about reducing bills, all right? Reducing bills like this was not unheard of, but it was rare. The Mishnah provides for rent reductions when, like, trees die or a blight spreads or when the winter is particularly harsh, but discussions of this kind never begin with the owner. They always begin with the renter. The renter, having been wiped out by a flood or having locust plagues, would petition the landlord for a reduced fee. But never would the landlord initiate the process. Never. So each farmer is astounded when he sees his bill and hears the words rent reduction. And they all wonder how they could be so fortunate. And the manager is only too happy to tell them. Well, he says, you know, I caught the old guy on a really good deal and on a really good day, and he was in a really good mood, and I decided that I should see if I couldn't do something for you. Actually, I've been working on this for a long time, and it all came together today. You know, something like that. The reduction may come from the master, but the manager lets it be known that it was his idea, okay? And how do the villagers respond? Well, imagine getting a call from the last salesman that sold you a car, okay? And the guy calls you and says, have you gotten your check yet? What check? You know, the check that's coming from the dealership. You know, I convinced the manufacturer to give you a $5,000 rebate for no particular reason, but just because I'm a good guy and you're good people, and they listen to me, so have you got your check yet? Now, that's really absurd, isn't it? Because we know that's not going to happen. But who's your new best friend? That guy right there. Only these guys haven't gotten a $5,000 rebate. 500 denarii was equivalent to a year and a half's wages back then. And that translates today to $50,000. So that's not just a small little rebate. Now, as quick as he can, the manager gathers up all of the freshly reduced contracts, and he dashes back to the master's office and this marks the beginning of scene four, okay? So scene four takes place back in the master's office again. This is where, to those who understood how things worked in Middle Eastern culture, everything becomes clear, okay? Up to this point, they were like foggy. They didn't understand. But as the manager reaches the master's office, the ink is still wet on those contracts. The master can see what's happened. He's no dummy. But he can hear evidence too, because out in the street, already going on out in the street, the tenant farmers are throwing a party. They're celebrating the name of their most generous landlord. Never before in history has there ever been a man so wonderful, so kind, so noble, and so deserving of loyalty and praise as this master. He hears this going on. Never before has a landlord reduced rents just because he's a generous person. As the sound of the three cheers for our master are going on outside, the master realizes that he has two options. He can explain that the reduction was a mistake, that the manager manipulated them, and that they're still legally obligated for the full amount. And in that case, the master's name goes from marvelous to mud. Okay? And they will curse him for his stinginess. Or he can keep silent and accept the praise, allowing this clever manager to ride high on the wave of popular enthusiasm. So what does he do? He reflects on his choices for a moment. He goes, let's see, reputation or money? Reputation or money? You see, for a man of character, it was a no-brainer. He turns to the manager and he says, shrewd move. You're a rascal, but you're a wise rascal. And Middle Easterners still tell a story today about a condemned murderer during the days of the famous Sultan Saladin. And the killer was condemned to death, and he kept crying, I want to see the Sultan, I want to see the Sultan. And finally, he was taken to the Sultan, where he cried out, oh, most gracious Sultan, my sins are great, but your mercy is great. Your mercy is greater, oh, great Sultan. And he was released. This is very difficult for us in the Western Hemisphere to understand. We cannot understand that. But for the Eastern mind, saving face and reputation was everything. The Bible says, a good name is more desirable than great riches. To be esteemed is better than silver or gold. That's Proverbs 22:1. The culture in that area of the world, well, they believe that. So you see how this story nets out? It's about a master who is generous and merciful, and about a man who has assets that are only at his disposal for a brief time. He doesn't control his own destiny, and he knows it. It's all in for him. And it's all in the master's hands. It's up to him. The question is, will the manager think about his situation? Will he make the most of his opportunity? And while he has assets at his disposal, will he squander them or will he use them before they slip through his hands? In essence, Jesus is saying this. He's saying, the shrewd move is to trust the master. The shrewd move is to bet the farm that he's generous and merciful. Many years ago, a pastor or an evangelist asked the question. I was a young boy, and I remember him saying this. What are you going to do with your one and only life that will last for eternity? I got to tell you, those words pretty much burned in my heart for a long time. And I think that's pretty close to the question that Jesus is raising in this parable. What are you going to do with the assets that you have? A shrewd guy uses what he has to gain a future for himself. In the verse that immediately follows this story, Jesus gives the first of three lessons from this story. He says in Luke 16:9, I tell you, use your worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Translated, it means this: you only have one life, so use it to enhance your future. Use it to build friendships with people who can say to you someday in heaven, thanks. Thanks, I'm here today because of you. You know, when I read that verse, it made me ask, what should I do with what's been entrusted to me? And hopefully that's the question that is coming to your heart right now. And it begs the answer. And my answer was, invest that life in making friends for eternity. The prospect of that was too enticing for me to ignore. It started me dreaming about some things, about being a part of a church where all of the insiders had bet the farm on God's generosity and mercy. And all of the outsiders who wandered in got a chance to consider eternity and give their lives to Christ so that they would spend it there with God. I started thinking about a church building their whole culture around the verse, use your worldly wealth to gain friends for eternity so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. See, I want heaven to be a place that welcomes me and all of my friends because we helped to steer people there. Sometimes when we're planning celebrations, I like to imagine the ultimate celebration in heaven, you know. And I imagine renting a room up there, you know, and having a church reunion where perhaps hundreds or maybe thousands of people we've gone to church with, all walking around and high-fiving and hugging and slapping each other on the back saying, man, you helped me get here. You helped me stay strong. This is so good. I'm so glad we did this. And someone coming up and telling you, because of you, I am here. Those are the words that we want to hear. And in my mind, that's a vision worth giving my whole life to. I think it's the ultimate vision that God is calling all of us to. It's the ultimate and final vision of this church up in heaven, celebrating together because we did our best to win friends for eternity. And I kind of like the words that the master used in talking to the manager when he said, shrewd move, shrewd move. He says in verses 10 through 13, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with very much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? I think that is Jesus' way of asking this. Do you want a big kingdom assignment here and in heaven, or do you want a little assignment here and in heaven? I think verses 10 through 13 are asking the question, what do I do with what has been entrusted to me? What do I do? And the principle behind the question is this: the better I invest what I have, the more will be entrusted to me. And then there's the final lesson. Jesus says, no one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the others. You cannot serve both God and money. And the verse asks the question, can I invest my life in two places? Can I work on my own stockpile over here and then run across and work on God's stockpile effectively too? And the answer is no. Can I ride the fence? Can I have it both ways? No, you cannot have it both ways. You cannot serve two masters. So I want to invite all of you who have maybe been on the fence. Maybe you feel like you've been on the fence. I want to ask you about making that decision today to become fully devoted to Christ and to hop down off of that fence and bet the farm on the one who gives you breath. You'll never regret it. You know, each week during this series, we've talked about what we could do so that you and God could do some work together throughout the week. You know, that's one of the reasons I hand out the worksheets, is so that you have something to refer to back to. If you're going through a quiet time, you can look at it and you can go over it and you can let it mull over in your mind. And I would like to challenge you to pray this prayer. God, I don't ask you for much today, but I just ask that you'd give me your heart for the lost. That's a prayer I'd like you to get up and pray every single day. Lord, give me your heart for the lost. Would you bow your heads in prayer with me, please? Lord Jesus, I thank you so much for the privilege of being here in your house today. Lord, I thank you for the privilege of coming before you and knowing that you have everything under control. Jesus, I thank you for these three chapters that we've been kind of camped in for a while, Lord. And I thank you for the stories and the lessons that we can learn from them. And Lord, today how we can learn about what it means to really bet the farm, to really be all in our relationship with you. Lord, help us not to be dishonest and do things for dishonest gain, but Lord, help us to trust in your mercy, knowing that we are human and that we blow it and that we fail, but trusting in your mercy and your generosity to us to not put us where we deserve to be. So Lord, I thank you and I praise you. Lord, as we go from this place today, I pray that you would just go with us, you'd guide us and direct us. Help us to allow your words to burn in our hearts, to change our lives for the better. And Lord, we'll be very careful to give you all the praise and all the glory in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.